Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today as we take a look at home improvement and we focus in a bit on home electrical with our two guests. Chad Spate back with us is the owner of Chad's Design Build, and he's been with us for a long time. It's always great to have him come by. Chad, welcome.
Thanks, Larry. Always great to be here. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. And also in the studio with me, Travis Larson, president and co-owner of Design Electric of Madison. Travis, good to see you. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
We'll talk with them about how to decide if you should do a wiring project yourself or bring in a professional. We'll take your questions, your home improvement questions. Maybe you're doing some updating. Maybe you need to update your wiring, as a matter of fact, for some things you're planning to do. Do you need to help? Need any help understanding LED lighting? Other problems? Maybe there's an outlet or a light switch that's creating an issue for you. All kinds of things we can talk about. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Travis Larson, we haven't had you on the program, so maybe give us your background a little bit and talk about your own business.
Well, I started in 1992, worked in a more of a commercial environment for a few years, and then in 1997 really started getting into the residential world in terms of industry-wise. I worked for a great company, Academy Electric, for 13 years, and my business partner and I decided to open our own in 2010, and we specialize in residential and only residential in the remodeling market.
Okay, so you got 8 or 9 years with your own company.
Yep, doing real well, having fun.
And Chad, how about you? How's business for you? You do all kinds of home remodeling.
That's right. Yeah, business is great. And I'll just say, full disclosure, Travis and I have been working together on projects since the late 90s. And and it's, you know, for us, it's also all residential remodeling. And it's really, it's been very busy for maybe 3 or 4 years now. And
So it's been
hopefully.
It's been going really well. What kinds of wiring capabilities are your customers looking for these days?
You know, I would suggest that one of the biggest things that we try to key into for our clients is lighting design and integration into existing homes. There's a philosophy oftentimes that simply because there's drywall or plaster in place that you can't really do much with it. And, you know, thanks to partnering up with a lot of different subcontracting trades, and you can do anything as long as you know how to get from point A to point B and have someone else who can patch it when we get there. So lighting's a big one. Older homes, Madison's got some great architecture, and there's a lot of homes built before 1930s, you know, that still has really old wiring in it. They call it knob and tube wiring for those who are familiar with it. And we do a lot of rewiring in that environment. So those are two of the bigger hot topics for our company.
You know, I wonder about if you got the knob and tube wiring, it's all inside the walls, and I guess you'd think it'd be what a mess to have to redo that.
It can be. Depends on the structure of the home. It can be that we've been lucky on a couple of them where it gets pretty easy and slick, but most of them it's just damage. And again, though, as long as you know what you're going to encounter most of the time, you can get your clients pretty well understanding what you're going to go through on it. And then it's just a matter of getting it done and getting it patched and going home.
Yeah. And Chad, you know, when you talk with your clients, what kinds of, let's just say lighting, are there any new things or different things, or what are they typically asking you about or for?
Yeah, well, so that's a great question. Certainly LED lighting has kind of revolutionized what we can do, and the biggest reason that there's been movement to LED, there are two actual that I know of, and Travis may add to it. I mean, one, it's certainly much more energy efficient to have an LED light.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, almost all of that power is going into generating light through the diode as opposed to heat, which is where you get the inefficiency in an old incandescent or halogen bulb. And then the other thing that is part of that is that because it doesn't generate the heat, And because of the way the technology itself is created, or the way it's physically produced, it can be very space efficient. So what used to be a can light that you would, say, a 6-inch can light that would almost take up a cubic foot up in the ceiling, is now something that you can almost mount on the surface, and it looks like a recess light, but it is, for all intents and purposes, a recess light, mm-hmm. but it's almost a flat fixture that's there, either just, inside the plane of the plaster or drywall. Yeah. Maybe it protrudes a little bit behind, or maybe it protrudes a little bit to the living space. But essentially, there's almost no need for additional hidden, circuitry.
Yeah.
And there's often a driver or something that is, installed somewhere remotely within the wiring. And Travis can speak to all that. But that has opened up all sorts of possibilities in lighting. You know, there's a light tape Travis and others have installed for us on some projects that, allows you literally to apply what looks like a piece of tape that has the diodes in it. And that goes to a driver and, you turn that thing on and you've got all sorts of things you can do. And it provides an amazing light and effects that you just couldn't get in the past.
Wow. So. That sounds pretty cool. Janet in Oak Creek, as long as we're talking electrical here, has a question relating to maybe a light and a fan. Janet, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you very much. So my question is, the house is about 15 years old. It is a fan-light combo, as you said, with the control on the wall. And when we first built, we had this problem one other time, and I'm experiencing it again a second time. The times I can get my light on, it might stand for a second. It will go off. The fan is no problem, but it seems like I have no control over my light, when I can get it to work and when it won't come on at all. When I had this problem in the past, the builder came out, looked at it. He said someone had a remote in the area that was controlling it. I'm not sure what he did to fix it. It went away for like 13 years, and now it seems like I just have no control over that light at all. So any idea?
So, Janet, this is Travis. Thanks for calling. You're talking about a paddle fan such as in a bedroom or living room or such, correct?
Yes,
okay.
In a bedroom.
And the wall control itself, is it a remote wireless control?
I don't have a remote for it.
The one that's on the wall, is it mounted where a switch would be or just up above it?
It's mounted where the switch is. So
okay.
We have, yeah.
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is exactly what your builder had mentioned 13 years ago, and that oftentimes there are frequency interruptions. One of the things that's happening with the newer technology and the wireless is they have a very long range. And there are brands that are more intelligent than others, if you will, and they can kind of adjust to different frequencies that come into the neighborhood. So if it's been working and now it turns on by itself and off by itself, or if you're having trouble, with consistency on it, my first guess would be that you've got either something in an adjoining room or, frankly, a neighbor on either side who's installed something similar. So there are frequency adjustments in the controller and the fan itself, depending on the brand. There are adjustments that you should be able to change the frequency. I'm guessing that's what the builder had done back the first time that it happened. The unfortunate part is it could also be that the controller's bad. Unfortunately, the wireless components do fail. 15 years is pretty early, I would think, in a lot of the better brands. So those are the two main pieces that you would look at. The adjustment is something that you could potentially do yourself. Going back to the original question where the controller is actually in a switch box, that would argue that it's hooked up to 110. So you're going to want to make sure and shut the power down when you do that. The instructions would show you where the adjustments are, and they're usually a series of dip switches that you just change the configuration so that the controller matches what's on the fan.
So you can do that yourself.
oftentimes you can. And again, a lot of it depends on the brand.
Janet, there you go. Good luck with that. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Janet.
You can call in, too, at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's take a call from Victoria in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Victoria.
Yes. My question is, can you put a higher wattage LED bulb or fluorescent bulb, like, say, a 60-watt bulb, into a lamp that recommends a lower wattage, say 40?
Boy, there's an interesting question. So if I'm understanding right, you're looking at replacing a 40-watt incandescent bulb with an LED that is giving you the equivalent of a 60-watt light bulb. Is that correct?
Yeah, you should be able to.
Yes, some of the things that we haven't tested in that industry yet are getting up into the higher wattages. So a 60-watt comparable LED is going to be in the 7 to 9-watt range oftentimes. And so when we talk about wattage ratings for an incandescent lamp socket, it is traditionally what the wiring is rated for, but oftentimes as well what the thickness of the plastic and the sockets are going to take with the heat. So LED bulbs do still create quite a bit of heat, because they are dissipating that heat off of the diodes inside. But when you talk about, in specifics, taking a 40-watt incandescent bulb and replacing it with a 9 to 11-watt LED, there really isn't any problem with that. It's when you start getting up into those higher wattages, into the 15-watt LEDs and into fully enclosed light fixtures, which they're really oftentimes not made to do, that's when you start having to ask a deeper question on that. For a lamp that's got a standard lampshade that's open on the top and the bottom, that allows air to pass by that LED bulb. It's allowed to breathe, if you will. Yeah, that type of change is fine.
There you go. Thank you, Victoria. Appreciate your call. And let's go to Carol in Randolph. Hi, Carol.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling because last fall I had a roof leak, and unfortunately the leak was coming in through a light fixture in my kitchen. So I turned off the lights, or I just taped off the light so we didn't use it, but we have since fixed the roof, and now I don't know how to, you know, if what I have to do before I can use that light fixture again. And I'm wondering if you can help.
Boy, that's a good one, Carol. How old's the house, please?
It's built in the 50s, but it was remodeled about 5 years ago.
So the kitchen was remodeled about 5 years ago? Okay. You know, there's a couple different conversations on that. Number one, the light fixture should be replaced. Unfortunately, and electrical is really very resilient. Oftentimes, you can submerge a light fixture in water and let it dry out properly and it'll be fine. The problem is it's mite. So what can happen with light fixtures that get wet is the cloth wiring will soak up some of that water and it starts to break down some of the jacketing. There can be corrosion that builds up on the sockets themselves, which can build up resistance. And those are the types of things that build up heat. So the first thing I'd want you to do is get a new light fixture there if you haven't already. In regards to the junction box, I guess a question would be how was it dried out? Was there any drywall that was removed or plaster that was removed around the light fixture in the process of allowing it to dry?
No, I really didn't do any of that.
Okay, so the insulation up top was probably just left as is, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, some of the things that can happen with that. Number one, outside of mine, and I'll turn this over to Chad, too, before we're all said and done, you should really have some inspection done on the insulation drywall because that can really wick up, soak up water pretty significantly and cause longer-term problems with mold. In regards to the wiring itself, the manufacturers of Romex wiring, the plastic wiring that we use now, suggest that anytime it gets water, that water can wick up into the cardboard that surrounds the leads, and they'll suggest that it should be replaced. You know, whether or not that gets replaced, oftentimes it's really hard to test where that water has or hasn't. So in an absolute statement, and this goes more into a lot of insurance claims too when we've worked on those, you simply replace the wiring from the switch up to that fixture.
Yes, and I would just add to what Travis said that, you know, the insulation that's up there in that ceiling likely is not going to be performing very well, having gotten wet over the period of the roof leak, depending on what the insulation material is. But if it's fiberglass, it probably clumped up, and it's not going to fluff itself back out. So what you end up with is just some clumped up material up there that is no longer providing much, if any, insulative value. And then that can contribute to more heat escaping at that damaged area that then can lead to ice damming and future potential roof leaking. So the good news is that by cutting out the drywall and replacing the fixture, which Travis recommended, you or a contractor will be able to assess the damage to the insulation, replace that so that it's back up to being restored. The replacement of the fixture itself will probably be less expensive if the drywall gets removed first, so that the electrician doesn't have to fool around much with trying to reduce that damage or minimize that damage. You just open it up, fix it, and then put it back together. And that way you're restoring the electrical, the insulation. If there's any structural damage, you can see it. There probably isn't, but it's better to know. And then you just patch the drywall and you're back to, you know, good as new. So that's what I think we would recommend.
Agreed.
There we go. Carol, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Taking a look at home improvement issues today on the program, zeroing in a bit on home electrical, but we'll take other questions as well with our two guests, Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build and Travis Larson, president and co-owner of Design Electric of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Tyler Dinner, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer, on the Ideas Network. Home improvement on our minds with Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build and Travis Larson of Design Electric of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Have an open line. Get you on fairly quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Nina next. Talk with Tom. Hi, Tom.
Hi there. Thanks for getting me on. This is more of just of a comment. We were doing some remodeling on our home on the electrical system, and out of interest, we just investigated what it would take to replace our current system with a solar electric powered system. And we found out that we could get a 7 to 9 year payback for a system that covered 100% of our energy usage, and we just had it installed and started up, and it was all very successful. So I'm just, you know, putting the comment out there that other people besides myself may be surprised how cost effective it is to be doing that, either when you're building a new home or you're remodeling an existing home.
Tom, thanks a lot for calling. You raised a good point. Chad, do you want to comment?
Yeah, well, Tom, you're absolutely right. I mean, we try to have this conversation with many of our clients that are thinking about significant improvements, and we've been involved in helping to have solar arrays installed on a number of projects. And it's certainly true that the price of installing these arrays has continued to drop over the last 10 years, and that just makes it a quicker payback. I'll add that there's still a 30% federal tax credit this year, and barring the laws changing, that 30% credit will reduce to 24% in 2020, and it will continue to kind of ramp down for a few years and go away unless future Congress passes something different. But that makes it that really helps make the payback numbers even better. The one thing I will caution, and has been my experience with this, with, for example, the city of Monona, which I'm on the city council there, and we put in a significant solar array on a couple of the municipal buildings, and we're seeing about 85% production compared to what was you know, promised, or what would have been the maximum production for the solar array. So once you calculate in that 85%, if that's in fact what you end up getting, you know, maybe your 7 to 9 year payback will become a, you know, 8 to 10 year or 8 to 11, whatever.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's part of it, but typically there are great warranties on many of these panels, and if it's not producing, your installer is hopefully giving you the tools to assess that. Typically there's software that allows you to see what each panel is producing, and then if one isn't working properly, it gets replaced. So it's really, you know, the technology and the payback on it kind of makes it a no-brainer. And I'll even go out there and say that I suspect 5 or 10 years from now, you know, we're going to see solar PV just all over the place. It's a way to deal with our carbon problem.
And it doesn't require, in terms of electrical within the house itself, wiring or any of that, there's no special requirements from that point of view?
Great question. So the one thing that's going to be changed, and so part of it, you know, the utility, many of the utilities that I'm familiar with in the Madison area are very cooperative and happy to work with homeowners or businesses and installing these systems. But you do end up putting in an electrical meter, which is bi-directional, which is to say that it is tracking the power you use, and then on, you know, midday when the sun is shining, you're getting more power than you're probably consuming, so your meter starts to turn backwards. And so that meter will be going backwards and forwards, and of course we all know that you end up paying the, you know, wherever you end up at the end of the month. And
sure.
So there will be months when you will probably have a negative meter, and if you have some natural gas use, you know, that will offset that credit. And the utilities basically just don't, in Wisconsin, they don't want to see anyone producing more electricity than they consume. So that's kind of the caveat. You know, you can't become a mini power
company
for the neighborhood.
Okay.
So
there you go. Well, Tom, thanks for bringing that up. I appreciate your call very much. We'll turn to Nancy in Madison next. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. I am going to be putting in removing countertops and a tile backsplash and putting in new granite countertops and new sink and faucet. And I'm assuming after I pull this tile backsplash off, I'll have to replace that wallboard. But ideally, I would like the look of no backsplash and just, you know, the granite sealed and then have a semi-gloss painted wall. And I just wonder, do you feel like not having a backsplash by your sink is a really bad thing, or do you think that it's sufficient to just paint?
Well, that's a great question, Nancy. Thanks for calling in. So typically, if you're not going to be putting up that new backsplash that, you know, goes from the counter up to your cabinets on the wall, which is what it sounds like you had previously, what would typically be done is a 4 to 6 inch piece of granite would be installed at the back of that counter to provide you with a little bit of a backsplash. And we generally recommend that for all the reasons that you would expect, particularly near the sink. It is going to be a wet location. Any sort of drywall or plaster is not really designed to be getting wet continually, but sometimes people do it, and all I would say is you're just going to have to maintain that surface and make sure that when it does get wet, you are drying it quickly. You know, you'll have a hand towel near your sink, and you'll probably be mopping up any water that's sitting on that caulk joint where the counter abuts the wall. It's just something you're going to have to tend to if you expect it to last.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Christy in Chippewa Falls, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Christy.
Hi, thank you. In my little den office There's a small closet that's dark without any wiring in it or any switch plate on the outside. And I'm looking for a recommendation. I was interested in the earlier discussion of LED lighting. And then also, if I go to a big box store, how do I know the quality of any fixture I were to buy? Thank you.
Christy, I'm going to address the second question first, and it's simply you get what you pay for. And I think that goes around in almost every environment. There are a very few exceptions to that. But when you talk about going to some of the larger retail stores and trying to buy light fixtures there, if you've got a light fixture that's $7 sitting next to a light fixture that's $20 and they look identical, the $20 one's going to be a better quality fixture. So that's, you can pay for some aesthetic considerations. You can pay for some architectural considerations when you step outside of that. But if they look the same and one's cheaper, it's going to be a lower quality fixture. So that's an easy one to kind of take at. So I need to go back to your dark closet. When you say a small closet, how big is it?
It just has a standard door and then maybe another 2-3 feet in.
Okay. So you mentioned LED in that conversation, and actually LED is considered the same as incandescent when it comes down to the amount of heat that it gives off. So you have actually more strict guidelines against the LED in a small closet like that, and we'd probably be forced, and again, I'm having trouble giving an absolute because I'm not looking at it. But my guess is based on that description and general storage and such, you're going to be put into a fluorescent consideration on that. And oftentimes to minimize the impact into the space and maximize the amount of storage, we like to put those right above the door. Mounted right on the wall facing in, so we blast all of that light in there. I've got a far closer distance to storage space that I can use with a fluorescent because the lack of heat that it gives off.
So a fluorescent light just on the inside of the door,
yep.
Sort of looking down on the...
Yeah, I wouldn't look, not necessarily down, but to a certain degree. If we mount it right to the header above the door, facing in, that gives us an opportunity for that light to splay up off of the ceiling, bounce around a little bit, mostly just forces the light in versus down.
Okay. Does that help, Christy?
It does. Thank you. And I just replaced in my basement 2x4-foot fluorescent panels that my house is 22 years old. And actually put LEDs in my basement, and it's nice and light and bright.
Oh, yeah, they're great in wide open spaces. You can get a lot more lumens per watt on that. Frankly, the color is traditionally a lot more comfortable than a standard fluorescent. Yeah, no doubt about that.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you, Christy. Appreciate it. Well, Mike in Madison has something for us. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Let me set the table here. We've got a light fixture over the living room table. And it's got about 5 fixtures on it. The lights that are in there are small size incandescents, and they burn out rather quickly. They seem to get really, really hot, and I don't know if they're frying themselves or what. This is on a dimmer switch, so I'm looking to find out what kind of a light I can swap those incandescents out that's dimmable, that won't burn out every week and a half or 2 weeks.
Mike, first question, are these light bulbs that screw in or do they push in?
These are light bulbs that screw in. It's a standard size, if you will, screw-in bulb.
Oh, okay. So it's got a standard regular-sized base to it.
Yes.
Okay.
The bulb itself is a smaller size.
Okay. Tell me about the lenses that are on each one of those heads. Are they frosted or are they clear?
Clear.
They are clear. All right. So the bulbs that you traditionally have in them, are they clear light bulbs or are they a frosted bulb?
Frosted.
Okay. Sky's the limit on that. There are some really nice LED replacements for that that are, in fact, dimmable. You do need to look at that. One of the hot buttons in terms of making sure that these are simulating the incandescence that we're used to is the color of those bulbs. We used to do in the old school fluorescent, we called it warm white and cool white. We've assigned numbers to those now. So what used to be called warm white, when it's trying to simulate an incandescent light output, is a 2700 Kelvin. So 27K or 2700K, that's going to be the most commonly referred to light bulb when you're replacing, say, a 60-watt incandescent bulb. And it's going to range from 2,700 all the way up to 5,000 Kelvin. And 5,000 is getting into that daylight range that's very blue, very cold. It's a great work light. You want to be a little bit careful about the living spaces you choose to put it in just because you're comparing what you're, you know, what you're used to. But in that one, in the living room, five bulbs, I would think that the things you want to keep in mind are the size of the bulbs, because some of the LEDs are a little bit taller. They can stick up above that lens if you're not careful. So I always recommend taking one of the bulbs that you usually use with you so that you can compare the sizes. But 2700 Kelvin and a frosted light bulb, if it says on the packaging omnidirectional, that's something that you want to pay attention to. Some LEDs push the light. They take half of the bulb and force the light up from there. They're made more often for track lighting and recessed lighting, and you get a dark line midway through the lens that can be kind of uncomfortable.
So you want an omni.
Yeah, omnidirectional, something that the light goes up, down, and sideways. But I think you're going to find that you have a lot of options for that style of a fixture.
Yeah. And Travis, could you add a little bit of information on the dimmer? Because as we know, sometimes the old, knob dimmers that you're turning aren't necessarily compatible with some of these LEDs.
Right. One of the things that the manufacturers are trying real hard to do is to make a dimmable LED that will work with a lot of different options. That said, it is very possible that the dimmer would need to be replaced with something new that is made to be a little more universally accepting of the dimmable compact fluorescent, the dimmable LED, and the incandescent altogether. Lutron Manufacturing is probably my favorite brand. I think they're one of the most successful in what they're putting out on the market right now, and they make a multitude of different styles that are what they call the CL dimmer. And you can buy those if you're interested in changing that stuff out yourself. It's a simple swap. There's no additional wiring changes that have to be made. So the dimmer that you have now would be a direct replacement as long as you get something with a CL. And you can get those at the Menards and Home Depot of the world. I believe I've seen them at a lot of the Ace Hardwares as well. So that would be something to look for. A great comment.
And the company again was?
Lutron, L-U-T-R-O-N. And that's the least amount of potential for buzz. These are electronic pieces, so they don't behave the same as an incandescent light bulb does. The dimming on them is far more intense. So a good quality dimmer is going to make the least amount of potential for buzzing and flickering and such.
Mike, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. And Lee in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Lee.
Yeah, good morning. What I have is a four-stall garage, a new four-stall garage. I have 200-amp service running to the breaker box in the building. I only have one outlet that's just right by the breaker box. Basically, the building has to be rewired. Is there a good book on the market that's, you know, self-explanatory, good for a somewhat beginner electrician?
Boy, great question. And unfortunately, because we all go through a very formalized training process, frankly, I've never looked. I would ask the magic Google machine. The internet is a great tool for that. Frankly, we refer to it when we've got oftentimes difficult, quick question and answers that we need to try to get some insight on. There's a lot of good conversations out there. But in terms of a specific title or author, boy, I'm sorry, I do not know. But I would ask that question of the internet and see if there's any conversation or chatter out there on that. The other thing you could look at is some of the technical colleges. Madison College here in Madison is a great resource. I see you're calling from Green Bay. I'm not certain if you know who the technical colleges would be up in that area. But you might want to check with some of the leaders at the technical college to see if they have a beginner's electrical. Oftentimes there are beginner's electrical courses that they offer, and they might refer to a specific textbook for that. That may be another source.
Yeah, that's a good idea, actually. Thank you very much, Lee.
Thanks, Lee.
Yeah, appreciate your call. Let's go to Susie in Eau Claire next. Hi, Susie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. First of all, I want to say when the repair guy is on, I always learn a lot, and I look forward to having him on.
Thank you.
Yes. My husband and I recently had the interior of our condo painted, and I want to use the command strips to hang up some lightweight pictures, and our painter told me I had to wait a while for the paint to set, which I have never heard. Yeah. But I want to know how long I should wait before I can hang up these pictures. And they're very lightweight. They're probably less than a pound.
Okay. Hmm. Chad, what do you think?
Well, you know, that is a great question, Susie. And it's, I mean, the technical answer to the question is that different paints will require different amounts of time. And it's hard to know. But what I would recommend, if I would contact the manufacturer and mm-hmm. ask that question, because it's probably somewhere on the order of 7 days to a month. Mm-hmm. I would expect that certainly a month would probably be if you allow it to cure a month, you're fine. But that, you know, is not a technical answer to the question.
Is, do you know the paint, the type of paint?
No, I really don't. You know, I just pick out the colors and let our painter do his thing.
Okay, and so did he not leave the can with extra paint or anything like that?
Yeah, he did. I just need to look. I'm just looking at my bare walls thinking,
look at that paint can, and I bet if you go online to the company itself, there's going to be common questions,
right?
And you're going to probably find it in a matter of a minute or two,
right? I mean, and so the can too will often say that, you know, you've got to let it cure for 24 hours or 48 hours, things like that. And that, you know, that is certainly true for before you would consider trying to wash off some sort of a stain or splatter or something like that. But with these little adhesive strips, I would probably want to give it a little more time. And
yeah,
so
You'll find that in a quick hurry. Thank you so much, Susie, for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, we're talking home improvement today. We've zeroed in a bit on home electrical, but we're answering other home improvement questions as well with our two guests. Chad Spate, he owns Chad's Design Build of Monona and Madison, and Travis Larson, president and co-owner of Design Electric of Madison. Join in at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at home improvement today with Chad Spate of Chad's Design Build and Travis Larson of Design Electric of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or phone at 800-642-1234. Tim in Cottage Grove emailed to say when he initially switches on his bedroom ceiling light fan, it works fine. However, if he switches it on again within a couple of minutes after turning it off, the light is dimmed. No amount of switching the light on and off fixes this. It will remain dim until he waits a certain amount of time and then turn it back on. This occurred when he first moved into the house. He thought it was the fixtures, so he replaced it, but it still happens. Any ideas of what that problem might be?
Boy, without a couple more questions, I'm not 100% certain I can weigh in with any certainty. I can say that I've never heard this before. I would want to know whether it was a wireless control, ceiling fan light in the bedroom. There could be some sort of a thermal protector inside of it, with the consideration that there's maybe too much heat building up. And if it were an incandescent light bulb, dimming it would thus cut down on the amount of heat being generated. I
think that's the answer.
Yeah,
I think that's the answer.
I don't know that I can weigh in on much more on that, though. Maybe a phone call. I'd be happy to ask some more questions.
All right. Let's take a call and go to Scott in Eau Claire. Hi, Scott.
Yeah, good morning, Larry.
Morning.
I have three-way switches that control my dining room light, and I think they call it a four-way because there's three of them. And about 7 years ago, I had an electrician install a dimmer on it, and it worked great until up about a month and a half ago, 2 months. Now you flip on, like, where the dimmer is, and you go to any of the other two switches by the back door of the living room, you can shut the light off. But if you go to one of the other switches and try to turn it on, you have to go back to the original one that you turned it off. And I bought a three-way to replace it, and I started thinking, I'm not quite sure which one to replace. And I just wondered how to determine which one needs to be replaced.
So, first question, you said that the dimmer was replaced about 7 years ago. Have any of the other switches been replaced since then?
No.
Okay, so it is identical to that situation. The only way we would be able to find out which one to replace would be to go in and start digging. It feels as if one of the travelers has failed somewhere. The least expensive option would be to start with the non-dimmer portions, because a three-way switch is pretty cost-effective. You want to pay very close attention when you're doing that to the way the existing one comes apart, because there is a specific format to how the wires go back together. But I would start at the switch, all things created equally. If the dimmer is still dimming and it still turns on and off and something failed outside of it, I would start on the outside lesser expensive ones and see where that takes you.
All right. There we go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And on to another caller. Let's go to Clay in Menominee next. Hi, Clay.
Yes. Question regarding spray foam on remodeling.
Okay.
What's minimum thickness by code for Wisconsin?
So thanks for calling, Clay. That's a great question. So the code asks us to, in new construction, to have an R19 in our walls. And so with a spray foam, typically you're going to get about an R7 per inch with a closed cell foam. And so that would argue for 3 inches of foam, which would give you roughly the equivalent of an R21. So that's possible to achieve in a 2x4 cavity because you have a 3.5 inches there. You know, nothing stops you from just filling it up, doing the full 3.5 inches and carving off the excess. That, you know, that would maximize it. But your question as to what is the code thickness, you would be aiming for 3 inches.
There you go. Thank you, Clay, for calling. And Christia in Madison, it's your turn. Hi.
Hi, I'm calling with a question about under cabinet outlets for the kitchen. We're doing a new home construction, and I would like to have under cabinet outlets instead of on the wall for an uninterrupted backsplash. My husband, however, would prefer to have them on the wall, and I'm just wondering if you guys can recommend this application or if you could maybe tell me of a good under cabinet outlet product out there.
Well, I'm not sure I can help with your dispute with your husband on who wins this conversation. However, in terms of a code compliant, there's nothing wrong with them as long as we make sure that they're in the standard 18-inch from the countertop range. We'd like to see that. So there's a couple aesthetic things you want to keep in mind. The true answer, there's nothing wrong with them at all. And I'll get you some ideas as to, you know, which ones to look at. The one thing you want to keep in mind, if you are a family that tends to keep appliances plugged in on the countertop, when you do the under cabinet outlets, you tend to see the cord more often than if you have a standard wall plug. If, however, you're really trying to minimize that clutter and you don't plan to have any of the appliances on the countertops themselves, the under cabinet outlets are a great way to get rid of that kind of eye spot and see the tile or granite backsplash of sorts. I'm presuming that's kind of the nature of your desire there for the design. Hubble Manufacturing makes a Home Select outlet box that comes in stainless steel and white. Task Lighting makes an angled plug strip that actually you can get in a multitude of different sizes. I believe 9, 12, 18, 24 are some of the standards, but you can custom order any size you want to on that. They can also integrate switches into that. You can integrate, I believe now they're coming with some USB charging devices that will get integrated into that. That's a really sleek way of doing that. And the outlets then are mounted at an angle, which make them a little bit easier to plug and unplug on a general day-to-day basis when you're not leaving them plugged in.
All right, there we go. Thank you so much, Christy. Appreciate your call. EJ in Phillips, Wisconsin, emailed to ask if whole house surge protectors are effective.
The whole house surge protector conversation oftentimes gets misconstrued with lightning protection. And in the end, if a client is looking for surge protection because they live in a high, heavy lightning affected area, they're not going to be as effective because you need to combine them with lightning protection. And that's a beast of a completely different animal. Otherwise, in terms of just general surges that may be coming from a heavy used utility grid, surge protectors can be a great tool. How effective they are is directly proportionate to how much you spend on them. So the more you spend traditionally, the better they are at absorbing higher surges. So they can be a great tool and very effective when they're used as they are intended.
And when we're talking about cost, what is the range of costs from the cheap ones you probably don't want to the more expensive ones?
You know, if you're looking to protect an appliance and only an appliance, you can buy a point of use surge protection device for $100 from one of the big electronic stores that works real well. If you're looking to protect the whole house with a multitude of different electronics, say if you have some pretty expensive appliances in the kitchen that rely highly on the electronics, you're going to want to get into a whole house surge protection device, and you can spend $300, you can spend $10,000.
Oh, so it's a very, very...
It's a big range.
Big range. Okay, let's go to Barbara in Glenbush. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, it's Glenn Beulah. And I have a home that was built in the 1930s. It was a very well-built home, and it basically has just had the breaker box replaced, but no other updates in the electrical. I've had minimal problems here and there. Maybe a light would need to be replaced. How essential is it to have a rewire of the house?
You know, Barbara, that's a great question. I appreciate the call. That's going to depend upon the wiring that was used when they built it. So that era home traditionally has a high occurrence of what we call knob and tube wiring, which is a free-floating, ungrounded system that runs through the whole house. And as a whole, frankly, knob and tube is pretty bulletproof. It does a real good job. It was built well. When it starts getting encased in insulation, which is very common in, say, a two-story house for the second floor, and if you've had insulation blown into the exterior walls, that knob and tube can get encased. And what happens in that, in an overloaded situation, and keeping in mind this is going back to the 1930s, so how often and how much it's been overloaded is oftentimes hard for one single homeowner to be able to determine. And the problems tend to manifest inside the walls where you can't see them. When they're encased in knob and tube, they cut off the ability to breathe. And knob and tube wiring needs air to pass by it to keep it cool. When you're passing more electricity through it, it tends to warm up. When you cut off the ability for it to cool, it tends to break down on the jacketing. And what can happen in that environment is we have the jacketing crack, get brittle, fall off, and sometimes you have a bare exposed copper wire that can be in contact with flammables. These are all, you know, worst case scenario topics. But when you ask the question, does it make sense or should you consider upgrading? Yes, I think it's something smart to consider. Have someone come in and take an assessment of what is or isn't left of the knob and tube, if at all. 1930s was when he started using some of the armor clad cable. So it is possible that you don't have any, depending on when it was built. The other intangible on that is if there is, you know, residual knob and tube throughout there, there certainly can be a resale potential on that. The newer insurance company situations are that they won't insure a house to a new homeowner oftentimes if the knob and tube is left intact. So there can be some benefits to considering that before resale.
There we go, Barbara. Thank you so much for calling. And Chad, we've got the NARI home show coming up. Can you talk about that a bit?
Sure. So the expo is coming up in 2 weeks here in Madison, out on the west side at the Marriott West or Marriott Madison. And it's a tremendous opportunity for homeowners to come out and meet with contractors and, you know, trade trade partners, people in all aspects of the remodeling industry. There will be, you know, window and door suppliers, lumber yards. And then there are a lot of free seminars that are also available. The dates are January 25th to the 27th. And if you go to the website, NariExpo.com, which is NariExpo.com, you can get all the information you'd ever want to know.
NARI.com. And give me a quick example of the kind of shows or so forth that are going to be.
Well, they're going to be seminars on keeping your basement dry, remodeling kitchens and bathrooms, how to hire a contractor, a whole host of topics.
And they're all available on the NARI on that website.
That's correct, yes, and it's NariExpo.com.
We, Chad Spade and Travis Larson are going to be with us up until 12:30 today. Chad owns Chad's Design Build of Monona and Madison. Travis Larson, president and co-owner of Design Electric of Madison. As I said, they'll be with us till 12:30. We'll take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back with our guests. You stay with us. Taking a look at all kinds of home improvement issues today, including home electrical, with our two guests. Chad Spade owns Chad's Design Build. Travis Larson is president and owner of Design Electric of Madison. Always great to have the chance to talk about home remodeling, and especially where these two guys are doing a wonderful job. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Donna in Waukesha has a question. Let's go there. Donna, hi.
Hi. I have some track lighting in my kitchen. And it's, I think it's the GU10 halogen fixtures that are in it. And last year, I decided I was going to upgrade all of my bulbs to LEDs. So I replaced them, and I bought them in a multi-box, so there was like nine of them or something in a box. I think it was Menards. Mm-hmm. But I'm finding that they're only lasting like from anywhere from 2 to 8 months. Is there something wrong with the halogen to LED replacements, or... they were relatively inexpensive. Am I spending too little money?
You know, that's a great question. So the GU10 base is 120-volt base, which means it's just taking the standard power coming off. So there's no mix-up between that and a low-voltage transformer or something that could be messing with it. Is there a dimmer that controls those?
No.
Okay, so there's no dimmer. It's simply an on-off switch. You know, the best I could offer if you're having them consistently fail is that they were probably inexpensive and not, you know, well produced. You can expect for a good quality GU10 halogen replacement. You can really expect to spend about $15 to $20 a piece on them to have them do well for you. So if you paid less than that. And those multi-packs, I am inherently distrustful of, simply because I have found that they don't tend to be the longest lasting. I think that your best bet is to hit one of a lighting showroom versus a big box store. I see you're up in Waukesha. There's a place called BBC Lighting, or I think Brass Light Gallery is a tremendous lighting place that's more of an artisan craft base. I don't know what they sell for light bulbs, but if you find yourself into a lighting showroom, they've got a very vested interest in making sure that they're selling you really good quality stuff.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. And Carol and Taylor, we turn to you next. Hi, Carol.
Well, thanks for taking my call. On a little different angle, I'm a recycler and a very frugal. I still use several pin-up lights, which I inherited from my mother, so they're from the 50s. And I use regular incandescent light bulbs. I'd like to use something more energy efficient, but the shades on these lamps are on a wire, spring wire thing where it sits right on the bulb.
Yeah.
So the two little spring loops that kind of just slide over the top of the bulb?
Pardon me?
The two little spring loops that slide over, pressure fit onto the bulb?
Yes, exactly.
I wouldn't have any huge concerns with that. I would argue that most of the LEDs that are out there on a mass-produced basis are having a non-or a plastic cover. And from what I have seen, they're pretty sturdy. I would tend to believe that the LED product in terms of physical strength is probably stronger than the glass of an incandescent. So there's nothing that I can think of in the top of my head that would cause problems. It depends on maybe the size of the bulb that you select in terms of whether or not they work on that spring. But I wouldn't have any huge problems with it.
Okay, so the spring could kind of just sit there.
Yeah, if the bulb is too small, the spring may not clamp tight enough, and the shade won't sit properly, and it'll mess around a little bit.
Oh, that's right. I was forgetting that that controls the shade a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Nothing of big concern, top of mind.
All right. Thanks, Carol. Appreciate it. And Sean in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Sean.
Hello. I was just wondering, I got a couple of house projects coming up soon where in my upstairs I'm doing the windows and having the drywall done. And I was wondering if you guys had an opinion on which job should be done first.
Windows and drywall.
So, Sean, are you planning to have the old windows completely torn out to the rough opening and new windows put in, or will it be a sash insert?
It's going to be, they're tearing it apart, redoing it all, because the last guy was a handyman that wasn't so handy.
Mm. Yeah.
So I just want to make sure it's done right.
Right. Okay. So in that case, I would say that the putting in the windows first would be your best bet, because then the drywall can be finished up to, you can insulate properly, first off, around that new window up to the rough opening, and all the, you know, waterproofing details are more tied to the exterior of the home, but still all of that should be done properly. And then you can tear apart any plaster or drywall that's in the way at that point, knowing that it's going to be replaced and restored as a second step. So that's what I would recommend.
All right, there we go. Thank you so much, Sean. Appreciate it. Mary in Green Bay emailed to ask the purpose of ground fault circuit interrupters. She has a couple in her house, and lately they seem to be mostly off. It's very annoying as one controls the outlet in the bathroom. The reset button often doesn't work. She can try it several times during the day, and occasionally it will work for a while. Turning on a light switch can cause it to shut down. Can she have the CFCIs removed? And Chad, you had an experience with that, didn't you?
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, Travis can speak more to the technical issues, but I recently was out in Seattle visiting my brother and parents in a home that they recently purchased, and the Christmas lights had gone out, and they couldn't figure out what was going on, and there was an exterior outlet that was tied to an interior outlet, which had the GFCI breaker on it, and when I reset it, of course, then the Christmas lights came back on, and that was a really simple fix. I will say that they had used some interior rated extension cords, which probably contributed to the short that tripped the circuit breaker. Now, so a lot of times people will think that an outlet has stopped functioning when, in fact, that breaker has simply been tripped. Sometimes we find that older breakers are very hard to reset, and Travis can maybe speak to this. I think it's often just a matter of replacing that fixture because they wear out. But they're really important to have, and many times in homes they are required by code within a certain distance of a sink or a shower or any sort of water feature which of course we all know you can electrocute yourself if you come in, you know, if something that's plugged into an outlet, say, drops into a tub or a sink, you would not want for that to continue to conduct electricity. And that's why that thing immediately trips off the power. And
there you go.
Yeah, to Mary's question specifically, the purpose of the ground fault circuit interrupter is it basically interrupts electricity when you become the path for voltage. So a circuit breaker in the main panel will not do that. So you can't remove them. However, I believe that the problems that she may be having is twofold. Number one, if they're older than 10 years, they need to be replaced. They've got about a 10-year lifespan on them, and that goes for any GFCI outlet. But the other, oftentimes, if there is an outside cord, like Chad's explained, bird baths, water heaters, Christmas lights that are joined together multiple times where there's a little bit of water that can seep through it or moisture. Those are the types of things that trip GFIs, and that's what a GFI is supposed to do when there is a short sensed on that. So can't remove them, but you can replace them, and that should help to fix those problems.
When you were, Chad, when you were talking about the Christmas lights, I immediately flashed on the old Chevy Chase Christmas movie, right. Where he's got a million bulbs outside and right. He can't get the thing to work.
Not sure. GFI protected.
Oh, man. Well, let's on to another call. Let's go to Lee in Green Bay. Hi, Lee.
Yes, Larry, thanks for taking my call. I love the show.
Thank you.
Say, I've got an old house that was built in 1883. Up in the attic, it's only got 8 inches of insulation. It looks old, but it does look like blown fiberglass. Mm-hmm. What the previous owner did is then he went and stapled 6 inches of the craft face insulation between the rafters. And I want to bring that up to a R40. Is that insulation between the rafters serving any purpose, or would I be better to pull that down and take the craft face off, lay it on top of the existing, and then finish up, you know, blowing in something that's going to bring me up to that R40? How would I go about handling that?
Well, Lee, thanks for the call. Those are great questions. The simple answer to your question is that if, in fact, the entire attic, you know, all of the roof and or the underside of that roof and any gable walls that are exposed, if all of that is insulated well, it is serving a purpose of conditioning or helping to prevent the attic from being as cold or hot as the exterior. It's buffering and tempering that space. And the sorts of things we have to be concerned about would be, where the air is leaking beyond that somewhat haphazard installation that you're describing. You know, it's the craft paper and it's been stapled up. And so air undoubtedly is leaking around that. And that's going to be warm, moist air in the wintertime. And it's then going to get up there and hit that roof deck, which is cold on the exterior side. And you could have some condensation happening. And so the simple answer to this question is that sometimes it's dangerous to insulate that roof. It has to be done very carefully and thoughtfully, and there's certain details that you really want to get right because you're not actively heating that attic, correct? It's just a storage space.
Correct. And the gable ends, there's three gable ends in there. They aren't insulated.
Okay.
And it does have like a 14, 12 pitch, so it's about 15 feet from the top of the ceiling joist to the peak of the house.
Okay. Yeah, so, you know, if you want to have a more comfortable storage up there, if you want it to be a little cooler in the summer and warmer in the winter, then it would make sense to go ahead and properly insulate that space. Typically, we do that with a spray and foam just because, one, you are getting the appropriate air sealing and R values if it's professionally installed. It also provides some rigidity to the roof structure, so there's another benefit there that you're not getting with that fiberglass. And then because it sticks on and it seals for both air and moisture, you don't have to worry about the condensation issues anymore. But in this case, unless you want to invest in really upgrading all of that, you might want to stick to just improving the insulation on the floor of that attic, knowing that then you're not necessarily going to be able to store things up there as easily. Because you really need, ideally, if you can get an R50 up there in that attic, that is really ideal. Is this
one of those situations where an energy audit might be helpful for a few hundred bucks?
You know, that's a great point, Larry, that we certainly would recommend that with any of our clients. And that way you're going to have someone come in and assess this who not only has the expertise of all these issues that I was just addressing, but they're going to see your attic and your home, and they'll be able to give you great advice. And then having paid for that audit, typically you will, if you do some of these improvements that make the house actually more energy efficient in the process, which I understand that's your goal, you know, then you might even get some cash back that will pay you for having gotten that consultation and doing it right. So that's a great way to go. And that's, you would go to Focus on Energy, you know, Google Focus on Energy.
There's a bunch of people in the Green Bay area who Focus on Energy would have the names of the proper people.
That's correct. If you put in by county, and they'll show you everyone in the county that is currently providing those services.
There we go. Thank you, Lee. Thanks very much for calling. Joe in Washburn emailed to say he knows when applying LED lights to a dimmer switch, a specific LED bulb must be installed that is dimmable, and we talked about that. He's heard and experienced LED lights glowing after the switch is locked in the off position. Is the dimmer leaking voltage? Can you address problems with wiring and LEDs, especially related to dimmer applications?
If the glowing, this is really an interesting question, and this is something that was brought to my attention recently. If the glowing is consistent and it doesn't go away, it's a very good probability that it is a backlit dimmer switch. The backlit dimmer switch, the Decorator Diva series as a specific call out from Lutron, the older style had a backlit faceplate so that when the light was off, you could actually see the dimmer and just kind of acted as an indicator light. Unfortunately, yes, that does actually allow a bleed through that will disallow an LED light bulb from being turned off. If the dimming or the glowing is contemporary, that's just the diode itself cooling down as it turns off. It doesn't. The power when it's cut off to an incandescent light bulb is gone immediately, whereas the diodes themselves will glow as they cool down. So if that answers Joe's question on that, it depends on the glowing that he's referring to.
Makes sense to me. Chuck in Stone Lake, your turn. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a question. I'm a very dedicated, my wife and I, listeners to NPR and WPR. And we built a new house, and we have interference with our radio based on LED fixtures that are under counter. And it's also really bad when we open our refrigerator door. Is there a fix for that, and what causes that interference with the radio?
Boy, I don't know the specifics on that, Chuck. That is a great question, one which we've seen even starting with the amateur radio. AM radio tends to see a lot of buzzing when you've got electronic devices. We first saw them in dimmers. Sometimes we saw them with electronic radios that were in close proximity to an old school AM radio. I do not know the fix, though I would suggest that there's most likely some sort of a filter that could be placed. I would think a whole house application would be in order. I have not researched the question specifically to be able to answer, but I believe that is very a common occurrence on AM radio specifically. The FM seems to travel further, and it isn't as affected by the electronics and the interference on that. So I do not know the specific answer, but it is a topic that has been talked about.
Chuck, if you want to email me, Miller at wisc.edu, M-E-I-L-L-E-R at W-I-S-C.edu, I will or just go to our website and pose that question. Our engineers here, I'm sure, have had that come up, and Al and one of the guys in the shop may have a good answer for you as well, because I am sure this has come up with other listeners. And thanks, by the way, for listening. We appreciate it. I certainly want your signal to be good and clear. So shoot me a note, and we'll see what we can if we can give you some additional information. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Joshua in Brookfield purchased a 3D printer and noticed that when it's heating, there's a low buzzing sound coming from the wall the printer is plugged into. Speaking of sound, he's been using it for about 5 months and there hasn't been a problem, seemingly. He took a thermal imaging camera. There are no hot spots on the wall either. Is this something he should be concerned about? And if it is, what does he need to know?
Well, Joshua, number one, I am very impressed with the thermal imaging camera. That is a great touch and actually quite important. I will turn it back, though, and say anytime I hear buzzing coming out of an outlet, that's never a good thing. So some of the larger scale printers do tend to draw a lot of power. So were you to ask me in a nutshell without being able to hear what your buzzing is, I would argue that the contacts in that outlet are probably failing. And the power that is being drawn from that printer requires a more solid contact. And what's happening is there's actually an arcing going on that's only going to get worse, that can damage the cord. If it is a noise that goes away after the heating up is done, that would even further my argument, because it's drawing less power when it's not engaging all of the parts of that printer. So I would try first changing out the outlet, because there's really nothing else that I can think of that would be actually creating a buzzing sound at that point.
Here we go. Chad, do you want to remind us about the NARI home show?
Sure. So the NARI Expo is coming up the last weekend of January. It's a Friday through Sunday, January 25th to the 27th. There are over 100 exhibitors, and there are probably about 60 presentations. I don't have that number right in front of me, but yeah, that's typically about what we have. And those presentations are going on. It's a Friday afternoon. I don't have the hours in front of me to apologize for that. But all the information Friday afternoon, most of the day, Saturday, and then up until 4 o'clock on Sunday.
And where do we find the information on all specifics?
All the information will be there at nariexpo.com. That's NARIEXPO.com. And it's a great opportunity to come out and meet people and ask questions and learn a lot about home remodeling, just like we do on this show. So.
Wonderful. And Chad and Travis, I want to thank you both so much.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's been great. Chad Spade owns Chad's Design Build of Madison and Monona. Travis Larson, president and co-owner of Design Electric of Madison. And say, thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. We have lots more in store on the Ideas Network.